community members for picking your strawberries. No one is illegal. Power to the people.
So that is John Caravello, who is a faculty member at California State University, Channel Islands, where Angel Marie Taylor, you teach. He was arrested the next day. We just have 30 seconds. He hasn't been released yet?
No, Professor Caravello hasn't been released. And as you've heard in that public comment, he has always used his voice to speak up for those around him. Myself as a student coming from an immigrant background, like most other students here in CUC Channel Islands, Professor Caravello has been continuously targeted because of his outspoken views to defend his community. And he was one of the protesters on the ground who was helping other protesters amidst the violence.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to cover this. As the judge in Los Angeles ruled that migrants can no longer be rounded up in Los Angeles without cause, Angel Marie Taylor, student and volunteer with 805 Immigrant Coalition, thank you for being with us. And Luis MacArthur, mayor of Oxnard, 10 miles from Camarillo, previously the police commander of Oxnard. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Support for KFAI comes from the Hook and Ladder Theater's Under the Canopy music series, presenting Chastity Brown in concert on Friday, July 18th. Based in Minnesota, with roots in Tennessee, Chastity delivers a beautiful and complex mix of gospel, roots, soul, jazz, blues, and country. Minneapolis-based singer-songwriter Anna Devine opens up. Tickets and information about Chastity Brown's July 18th show at the Hook and Ladder are available at thehookmpls.com.
I just found out I'm listening to Fresh Air Community Radio. That's KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis, St. Paul, at onlinekfai.org, and you're listening to...
Today on Mini Culture Presents, we are going to be airing Noise, a human history of sound and listening. It is a six-part series. This is an expanded version that we're going to be hearing today, and we will be airing part three for the full hour. So prick up your ears and enjoy.
What if history had a soundtrack? What would it tell us about ourselves? This BBC radio series was made in collaboration with the British Library Sound Archive. It explores the human dramas that have revolved around sound at various points in the last 100,000 years, allowing us to think in fresh ways about the meaning of our collective past. Noise, A Human History, is written and presented by Professor David Hendy. Sounds of the Spirit and of Satan.
Noise, A Human History, The Bells.
If you lived in the Middle Ages, one of the most common noises you'd have heard, and probably one of the loudest too, would have been the sound sent flying out every day from churches, temples, and monasteries. It was the bell. And each time one rang out, religion's extraordinary hold over the secular world would have been signalled loud and clear. Here, inside the Church of St. Lawrence in Caversfield in Oxfordshire, is one of the oldest in Britain, cast in the early years of the 13th century. At the moment, it's standing at rest here in the corner of the ground floor of the church, and I am actually allowed to just knock it so we can actually hear it a little bit. But of course, nearly 800 years ago, it would have been positioned much more strategically near the top of St. Lawrence's Saxon Tower. Here in the graveyard, looking up at St. Lawrence's Tower, it's clear that the bell would have been heard by anyone for miles around, people inside their homes, anyone passing through the village on foot or horseback, or toiling away in the fields nearby. They would have heard the bell and known that they had to stop and celebrate Mass. And if they came to the church here, They'd have been guided through the service by a series of auditory cues. So a bell would ring to alert them to a particularly sacred moment so that they'd know when to bow or look up. And tiny bells would have been attached to the priest's robes, tinkling as he moved about near the altar and the pulpit. This, at least, was the sound of a church in this particular corner of Europe in the Middle Ages. But Christendom was a large place, and other parts had their own distinct style. The richest array of sounds would have been heard at the services held in Coptic and Orthodox churches, in places such as Syria, Armenia, and Georgia, where, together with cymbals, singing, and intoning, bells created one of the world's richest soundscapes of devotion. In much of Eastern Europe and the Near East, though, Orthodox Christianity was signalled by the distinctive beat of a hammer striking wood. It's the sound of a cimantron, a suspended wooden board struck in different places to produce different tones, and with a skilled operator, complex messages can be beaten out. The wooden cimantron was often a pragmatic response to metal bells being outlawed. Bells were loved and venerated, but they were also feared and sometimes suppressed. One of the reasons Istanbul today is so richly layered with sounds is that it's long been a meeting place of two continents, Asia and Europe, and two great religions, Islam and Christianity. In the Middle Ages, when it was still called Constantinople, the city was the centre of Orthodox Christianity. But in the 15th century, it came under the control of the Ottoman Turks. And there was an immediate impact on its soundscape. An Islamic council had already decreed in 630 AD that calling the faithful to prayer should be done by means of the human voice. This ruling had allowed a wonderful array of vocal tones and styles to flourish across the Muslim world. But it meant, of course, that Christians, even if they could ring bells quietly indoors, had to quieten or even silence their bells outdoors. The wooden cimantron, cheap to make, around for centuries, came into its own, summoning followers without the piercing effect of a metal bell. Wherever the Orthodox Christian Church took root, so did the cimantron, and as it spread, it adapted to local conditions. In Ethiopia, Christians would strike stones. In Syria, Greece, or Russia, it would be bars or plates or rings of metal. But wherever they were, here in the Ottoman Empire or elsewhere, people put bells or their equivalent to a rich variety of uses, not just calls to worship. And they heard in their sounds a whole range of subtle meanings that have now been lost. The bell was a powerful means by which a parish church, temple or monastery could project its power, define its territory and regulate behaviour across a whole neighbourhood. It served, for instance, as an official timekeeper to the community at large. Civil authorities also made use of bells to mark time. In London, under William the Conqueror, the nightly curfew was rung out from St Martin's le Grand at 8 p.m. and then taken up by other churches nearby as a signal for all city gates to be closed. The curfew that fell across old Beijing in the days of the Mongol dynasty was described by Marco Polo.
There is a great bell suspended in a lofty building which is sounded every night, and after the third stroke, no person dares to be found in the streets unless upon some urgent occasion. Guards, in parties of 30 or 40, continually patrol, and make diligent search for persons who may be from their homes at an unseasonable hour after the third stroke of the great bell.
Different messages often involve different bells or different rhythms. People within a parish boundary usually knew whether it was time to get down on their knees and pray, to mourn, to panic, or simply to return home. Yet people were responding to something more ancient and pagan in spirit, more deeply embedded in folklore. They were in awe of the sacred power of bells to dispel evil. If we take a look at the 800-year-old bell here in St. Lawrence in Caversfield, you can see that there's an inscription all around which reads, "In honour of God and St. Lawrence, Hugh Gargate and Sibylla, his wife, had these bells created." It's a simple and modest inscription, and lots of bells had messages carved onto them, often much more forbidding.
I disperse the wind.
I put the cloud to flight.
I break the thunder.
I torment the demons.
I put the plague to flight.
My voice is the slayer of demons.
Through the sign of the cross, let all evil flee.
If all this sounds like a series of spells, it's because they were. When a bell rang out, it was believed that any words written on them would also be sent flying through the air to do their work. It's why in the 15th and 16th centuries, for instance, the city authorities in Peking maintained an enormous bell, which weighed about 50 tons, covered inside and out with Buddhist scripture. Across China for centuries, smaller bells sounded in ceremonies to create an aura around homes and sacred relics and temples. Here at Caversfield, priests and parishioners would have processed into the fields, ringing their handbells to invoke blessings on the crops. Handbells made the beneficial effects of a church bell transportable. But for the church, of course, this created a new problem. If bell ringing worked for a priest, why not also in the hands of a simple peasant farmer wanting to protect his pigs, say? Well, the church's answer was to distinguish between bells that were blessed, and lay people could use these for ordinary workaday miracles, and bells that were baptised, which had much greater power, but would remain firmly in the hands of the priesthood. It's one of the reasons why, in towns across Europe, houses were built close together around a church. People wanted desperately to be in its protective aura of sound. For as Thomas Aquinas declared,
"The aspiring steeples around which cluster the low dwellings of men are to be likened, when the bells in them are ringing, to the hen spreading its protective wings over its chickens. For the tones of the consecrated metal repel the demons and arrest storms and lightning."
The same raging struggle between good and evil was played out in sound right up to and beyond the grave. When someone was sick, a bell ringer would walk before the priest as he came to visit. As death arrived, a passing bell or death knell would be rung to drive away those evil spirits waiting to seize a departing soul. Underlying everything was the feeling that sound, moving invisibly through the air around us, was a means not just of passing information, but other less tangible qualities, especially goodness or evil. It was a fundamental belief that would shape many other aspects of medieval life, from healing and entertainment to architecture and our relationship with the cosmos.
Noise, a human history, tuning the body.
One of the 14th century's international bestsellers was a book of anecdotes called the Gesta Romanorum, the Deeds of the Romans. It contained a cautionary tale about the seductive power of sound. Emperor Theodosius was out hunting when he suddenly heard sweet music and promptly rode off with his horse to track it down. He reached a stream.
There he saw a certain poor man seated on the ground, having a harp in his hand. From hence arose a melody, and the emperor was refreshed and exhilarated by the delicious tones.
The harpist turned out to be a fisherman and unhappy. For 30 years, thanks to God, the sweet chords of his harp had enchanted the fishes straight into his hand, and he could feed his family. But
a certain whistler has arrived within these few days from another country, and he whistles so admirably that the fishes forsake me and go over to him.
The emperor gave the poor fisherman a golden hook. The strumming of the harp worked its magic once more. The whistler retired in defeat. The anonymous author of this tale then helpfully explains to his readers that they, poor sinners, were the fish, the emperor, Christ, the fisherman, a priest, the harp, the word of God, and the whistler, the devil himself. The Middle Ages were awash with moralizing tales, but what's fascinating about this story is that it shows a battle for the human soul where the chosen weapon for both good and evil was sound. In the 14th century, talking, playing, music, listening, all these had to be done properly if you were to get along in this world or the next. The Gesta Romanorum was in Latin, so its real audience was the priesthood, who could apply it in their daily work. For instance, in the intimate space of the confession box. It's perhaps fitting that it was in here where your face was hidden and the priest could only hear your voice that you'd be lectured about the temptations of the senses. You'd be told about the sins of the tongue, idle words, boasting, flattery, lying, backbiting, gossiping, blasphemy. And then you'd be told about the sins of the ear, eavesdropping, listening to the siren pleasures of music or the seductions of devilish words. The confessional was like a medical dispensary. It was where you learnt how to hold your tongue and shut out the harmful noises. Here in the main part of the church, near the altar and the pulpit, parishioners were definitely required to let in certain sounds, such as the words of the priest. Not just the words, the very sound of a priest's voice also had force. Medieval religious writing often refers to God's voice as sweet or like a wind, bringing the Holy Spirit and touching, indeed changing, whoever heard it. It was especially important to recite God's words at life and death moments. When a Benedictine monk was close to death, for instance, he'd have the Gospels read to him day and night. As he slipped away, more monks would come to his bedside and chant the creed. Then, when his body lay at rest in the church, they'd sing psalms continuously in its presence. Monasteries reverberated with the sound of human voices spreading moral power. Among God's most zealous followers, medieval ideas about noise could sometimes be taken to extraordinary lengths. Today, still, in the Italian town of Guardia San Tremondi, Christian penitents walk through the streets every 7 years, whipping themselves and ritually piercing their skin with pins till the blood flows. In the 14th century, when the Black Death ravaged Europe, there were flagellants travelling from town to town, whipping themselves even more ferociously, wailing, singing hymns, chanting loudly. The craze never took off in England, but one of the best accounts comes from the medieval chronicler Robert of Avesbury, who described a group from Flanders whipping their naked and bleeding bodies during a tour of London in 1349.
Four of them would chant in their native tongue, and another four would chant in response like a litany. Thrice they would all cast themselves on the ground in this procession, stretching out their hands like the arms of a cross. The singing would go on, and each of them in turn would step over the others and give one stroke with his scourge to the man lying under him.
Even at the time, most people regarded the flagellants as absurd, but their use of sound was consistent with mainstream medieval thinking. In seeking penance, they believed that evil might be driven away by the sheer force of noise. In fact, most medieval attitudes to sound were based on the best science available at the time. A great deal of rigorous thought was applied, for instance, to harmony. The deepest thinker on such matters in the medieval period was probably Boethius, who pulled together the writings of Greek, Arab, and Latin philosophers, and especially the work of Plato, to explain the existence of three kinds of music. There was the music of the spheres, made by the cosmos itself as the planets moved through the heavens. It was real and loud and never-ending, but existed beyond the normal range of human hearing. Then there was instrumental music, from, say, trumpets or bells, or indeed from voices singing. Finally, there was human music, the sound generated within each human organism. This bound together body and soul, but like the music of the spheres, was inaudible to our own ears. Now, since all these sounds had a mathematical basis in terms of frequency and pitch and so on, it made perfect sense to think that an orderly, godly universe would involve them all being in alignment. The music binding together body and soul, for instance, needed to be in tune with cosmic harmony. Indeed, a person could be thought of as being like a musical instrument that occasionally needed retuning. And instrumental music, though it could lead you astray, might also be thought of as a means of putting things right. Music could offer a form of therapy. At St. Augustine's Abbey in Canterbury, we get a small but significant glimpse of the church's strict stand against music being broken, at least when it came to treating the gravely ill. At some point in the 13th century, new guidelines were issued to the monks running the abbey's hospital.
When it happens that any brother be so weak and ill that he greatly needs the sound and harmony of a musical instrument to raise his spirits, that person may be led into the chapel or carried there so that, the door being closed, a stringed instrument may be sweetly played before him by any brother or by any reliable and discreet servant without blame.
It was a musician rather than a physician who was seen as providing the best relief. And in other medieval records, mania, melancholy, fever, insomnia, plague, lethargy, catalepsy, epilepsy, consumption, you name it, and we find that having a musician play at the bedside was seen as the most effective response. We need to avoid looking back at all this with condescension, judging it as yet another example of that irrational medieval mindset. We're not so very different now. We buy CDs of Gregorian chants and other calming music in the belief, as the advertising blurb puts it, that it will help restore our inner peace and harmony. In the 13th century, the arcane theory of the music of the spheres was already being questioned, and music wasn't always offered in the hope of some profound metaphysical transformation. Playing music and whispering comforting words into a patient's ear was increasingly given in a purely compassionate attempt to lift the spirits. The medieval world was learning more and more about sound, not just as some supernatural entity, but as a powerful force in the flesh and blood realm of living people.
And you are listening to Mini Culture Presents here on Fresh Air Community Radio, KFEI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, Radio Without Boundaries. Noise, a human history of sound and listening, will continue right after these messages. Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members, just like you, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for KFAI comes from the Dakota, presenting Keiko Matsui Wednesday, July 16th. Contemporary jazz pianist, composer, and humanitarian Keiko Matsui is touring for her 30th album, Euphoria. More information for Keiko Matsui at the Dakota can be found at dakotacooks.com.
This is Arlo, and they said they'd put me on the radio if I said that I like KFAI. That's the best deal I've had all day.
Support for KFAI comes from First Avenue, presenting Big Star Quintet, Wednesday, July 23rd. The last surviving member of the original Big Star lineup, Jody Stevens, teams up with Mike Mills from REM, John Auer from the Posies, Pat Sansone from Wilco, and Chris Stamey of the DBs to create Big Star Quintet. Big Star Quintet takes great pains to deliver the songs the way one hears them on the records, without wheeling out musical carbon copies. Spin.com says that Big Star Quintet gives Big Star's music what it deserves, a passionate reunion meets tribute. Opening the show is Chris Stamey. More information for the Big Star Quintet live at First Avenue is available at first-avenue.com.
Welcome back to the BBC series Noise, A Human History.
Noise, A Human History. Heavenly Sounds.
Walk into any great religious building from the Middle Ages or the 16th and 17th centuries, and you'll suddenly enter what's still one of the most distinctive soundscapes you can ever experience. Whether it's one of Christian Europe's cathedrals, a Hindu temple in India, or one of Islam's grander mosques in the Middle East, North Africa, or Central Asia, as you cross the threshold and leave the sounds of the world behind, you emerge into an enclosed, cavernous universe of stone. A peacefulness descends. Silence, though, is elusive, for large spaces bounded by stone will always reverberate loudly. A door slams, a prayer book is dropped, a child coughs. These sounds ricochet around the sheer walls, domes, and high ceilings. Preachers and singers didn't just make do in these tricky acoustic spaces. They created sounds that fitted them beautifully. In any faith, the words of a preacher had to be heard. So inside the sandstone courtyard of the vast Babri Mosque, which once stood at Ayodhya in India, several large recesses were built into the walls to project sermons outwards to everyone at prayer, while killing off unwanted echoes. In Christian churches and Hindu temples, music or singing was a vital part of most services. The basic task was much the same, to find the perfect match of setting and voice. In this, both musicians and architects succeeded magnificently. If you were to walk into, say, the beautiful Romanesque chapel of the Abbey of Vézelay in Burgundy, the effect would have been stunning. as you enter the nave, you see the sunlight from the windows above fall in shafts onto the pale stone walls and floors. And then there's that moment when you appreciate the special acoustic dimension of this place. You can hear the sound of the nuns and the sound of the abbey merge into one. And the effect is even more marked if we were to listen to Yegor Reznikov, the music historian who analysed the resonant qualities of caves for us. He's an expert on Romanesque music, and so he regularly performs here at Vezelay as part of his research. Volume and pace, using not modern scales but a more ancient style of chant, Reznikov's singing voice doesn't get lost in a series of uncontrolled echoes. Instead, it becomes tuned to the abbey. It's more like a resonant harmonic sound, as if the singer and the abbey merge into one. None of this would work if it weren't also for the building's design. Curves were a crucial element of the acoustic design of all these Romanesque churches. They focused the sound of a singing voice and prolonged its harmonics. At Vezelay, walls and ceilings were treated not as flat or smooth entities, but as brilliantly exploitable three-dimensional objects. Reznikov refers to it as the human scale of the Romanesque. The soaring Gothic cathedrals that became widespread in Europe from the 13th century were undoubtedly more spectacular visually, but increasingly out of kilter sonically. There were still ways of working within these soaring and dramatically more reverberant Gothic buildings. Polyphony, in which different parts of a choir sing with more than one note at a time, was an infinitely adaptable style. It might have started as a casual experiment or even by accident, but with a little practice, the reverberation of a particular cathedral or abbey created just the right mix of overlapping tones and prolonged notes, and instead of acoustic chaos, a kind of soaring celestial harmony was created, which somehow matched the building's soaring architecture. In India, at roughly the same time, musically minded architects managed quite literally to fuse together sound and stone. Pillars of solid granite were intricately designed to be played as musical instruments, like these pillars in the Porandar Mantupa Hall built at Hampi in Karnataka during the 16th century. Pillars were actually individually tuned by means of their length, width, and even tension, adjusted by varying the load from above. A whole range of different sounds could be deployed to match devotional readings and dances. Temples of all kinds also give us clues about the more worldly role they played as stages for the display of political power. And there's a striking example of that here in Venice, in the Basilico San Marco, right next to the palace of the city's one-time ruler, the Doge. I'm now inside San Marco, surrounded by its stunning glittery mosaic, and on the roof, five interconnected domes. Acoustically speaking, this is quite a complicated space, but as I reach the chancel and the pulpits, it's possible to notice some slightly strange 16th century modifications. And here in the chancel, which is screened off from the rest of the church by a rood screen, there are not one, but two singing galleries facing each other. Now, these modifications were made under the direction of the Doge's famous architect, Jacopo Sansovino, and his new musical supervisor, Adrian Willaert. But why? What was going on here?
The most likely answer has been provided by choral experiments here by the choir of St. John's College, Cambridge, conducted by Dr. David Hill. They sang one of Willaert's psalm settings without any rehearsal. This wasn't about a pristine performance, but testing out the acoustics. In this part of St. Mark's, they tried a chant choir in one of the singing galleries and a four-part choir in the other one facing them. It creates a clear dialogue effect. But when there's a four-part choir in each gallery, the sound is even more striking. There's just the right amount of space between the two groups, and a beautifully clear effect is the result. Stereo. Willaert hadn't actually invented the double choir formation, but here in San Marco, it was performed in the very same part of the church in which the Doge and his fellow dignitaries were ensconced, the chancel at the centre. And this really was a church within a church where only the great and good got to hear the music in stereo hi-fi. It's interesting that the chroniclers who describe the visit of Henry III of France to Venice in 1574 refer a great deal to fanfares of trumpets, to fifes and drums, to bells, artillery fire, and even singing. And it's clear that in these ceremonial events, sound was being used to express power and status, just as much as the visual spectacle on offer. Religious leaders were obviously wary. In the West, especially, they listened to the pomp and ceremony of the aristocratic courts and worried that ecclesiastical authorities no longer had a monopoly in the use of sound as spectacle. As for the secular rulers and aristocrats, maybe they had something to worry about too. Even the peasants of the medieval world could make a great deal of noise and, very occasionally, use it to upend the whole social order.
Noise, a human history. Carnival.
21st century austerity economics, it seems, has created its very own signature noise. The clattering din of metal pots and pans being banged as people march down city streets. It was the sound of the millions of indignados who filled the Spanish streets in May 2011 to express their frustration at becoming the latest victims of the global economic meltdown. It was heard again a year later when the students of Montreal protested against huge increases in university fees and thousands of other citizens joined them. In October 2012, casserole protests against the banks erupted in Lisbon, London, Madrid, New York, Istanbul, in over 100 other cities stretching from Argentina to Japan. Using pots and pans in every location, creating a shared global sound, is both deliberate and symbolic. anyone can join in, since the musical instrument of choice is simple and cheap. Everyone's grievance is somehow connected. Perhaps, most potently of all, it's a noise that draws on a history of disruptive music-making by the oppressed that goes back more than 700 years. Then, as now, there was a thin line between protest and carnival. Christianity had started out as one of Rome's mystery religions, with many of its followers losing themselves in ecstasy. And for centuries afterwards, church services featured parishioners and priests singing and dancing together, as in the celebrations for St. Eleanor's Day in Wales, described by one 12th century traveller.
You can see young men and maidens, some in the church itself, some in the churchyard, in the dance which wends its way round the graves. They sing songs, and all of a sudden they collapse on the ground. And those who until now have followed their leader peacefully, as if in a trance, leap up in the air, seized by frenzy.
Naturally, official church thinking disapproved. If parishioners' senses needed stimulating, let it be done through more disciplined singing, incantations, incense and bells. And all that wilder stuff, the dancing and the ecstasy, should be pushed onto the streets outside. Once outside, people were free to start creating their own sense of what it meant to step away from their ordinary, everyday lives. So on a feast day or holy day, any time between the 14th and 17th century, we'd hear mixed together in the streets of almost any European town the sounds of mystery plays reenacting biblical stories, lively processions featuring dignitaries and various craft guilds, tanners, coopers, hosiers, butchers, bakers and so on. There'd be banter, rivalry, games, wrestling, animal baiting. And a deaf ear would be turned to songs poking fun at local bigwigs. Perhaps someone got up as a lord of misrule, whose duty it was to ensure a steady stream of buffoonery. The School of Theology in Paris declared in 1444 that there was real social need for a little foolishness. After all, it said, wine barrels burst if from time to time we do not open them and let in some air. Things, though, sometimes got out of hand. With cheap beer and wine flowing, town centres occasionally would slide into drunken, debauched and violent no-go areas. The opportunity was taken to settle old scores, everything from poking fun at notorious individuals who'd broken social conventions to full-blooded insurrection. Matters certainly ran out of control in Wells in Somerset in May 1607. One group of parishioners had decided to organise a church ale to raise money for repairs to their church. It was the kind of charity event that would usually last a day or two. But in 1607, the citizens of Wells stretched it out for 8 weeks. The organisers laid on all the stuff of 17th century popular entertainment, plays and burlesques from every neighbourhood and trade guild, dressing up as the May Lord and his court, reenacting the tales of Robin Hood and his outlaws, Morris dancing. On and on it went, as did the drinking. Throughout, the noise barely stopped. The street dancers following the May Lord and his lady were accompanied by fiddlers and horn players and drummers, weaving their way through the streets, as the record said, with much hooping and hallowing. The trumpets would be blasting away, perhaps to disturb the night watch or taunt the bishop in his palace. there'd be the non-stop beating of drums late into the evening. No one had actually hired the drummers. They did it, they said, purely for pleasure. At regular intervals that summer, Wells also resounded to the din of a Skimmington ride or a charivari. It was then that the so-called rough music would begin. This was a tradition that stretched across Europe. Groups of people would gather at night, armed with pots and pans and cowbells, and set off to harass some poor person, a widow or widower, perhaps, who'd remarried someone scandalously younger. The rabble-rousers would stand outside their house, and with a loud clattering and a great deal of singing and shouting and roaring of animal noises, they'd stir them from their slumbers and taunt them for hours. The reputation of the medieval charivari is of a boisterous but essentially genial affair. Frankly, it was often an occasion for bullying. By the 17th century, it was also taking on a more political dimension. In Wells, revellers targeted the city's civic and business leaders and the Puritans who tried to suppress the festivities. Some of that festive drumming was designed deliberately to drown out attempts to disperse the revellers. Then there was the gunfire. One of the men targeted by the revellers at Wells later accused them of being armed with unlawful weapons. To those on the receiving end, carnival was beginning to feel more like a cover for rebellion. The uncontrolled noise certainly spoke not just of pleasure and abandonment, but also of underlying discontent, anxiety over plague, price rises for bread, or just grinding poverty. Ordinary people were often only able to express their political frustrations in the coded words and songs of festival, oaths, toasts, seditious riddles, ballads, even airs whistled in the streets. The sound of the pancadão, or big punch in Portuguese, recorded by the ethnomusicologist Leonardo Cardoso. It's one of the many rhythms that today make up the rich sound salad of the Brazilian favela in one of São Paulo's neighbourhoods. The pancadão is a street party. It takes place when cars are parked close together, blasting music from their speakers, at least until the police shut them down. It's not quite Latin American carnival as we imagine it, but it's just as much in the tradition of the medieval European carnivals as the much bigger, glossier displays put on in Rio de Janeiro. There's no universal model of what carnival should be, of course. And one of the things that make Brazilian versions distinctive is that the religious festivities brought to the country by the Portuguese colonizers of the 16th and 17th centuries were fused together with other influences from Africa, as well as native traditions. In the 19th century, for example, former slaves who'd been working in the sugar plantations brought to the Brazilian carnival tradition frevo music, which turned European marching tunes into syncopated rhythms and improvised fanfares. Processions also featured warriors who danced, leapt, and duelled with each other in mock combat, ringing the cowbells on their backs as they moved. What these organised processions share with the pancadão of the favela, the casseroles of Quebec, and all their European ancestors is the participants' desire to step aside from the normal routines of work and let themselves go for just a moment. It's no coincidence that, as in Europe 400 or 500 years ago, it's the poorest who are the most enthusiastic about these events. And it's often a cue for the well-off to leave the city for the quiet of the countryside. For them, as it was for the Puritans of Wells back in 1608, carnivals, skimmingtons, street parties, whatever, they're all an expression of vulgar popular culture teetering on the edge of violence. Most of this, of course, is, always has been, paranoia. But in one respect, the rich are right to be wary. It's been the dispossessed's way of saying, I am here, I exist, I won't be ignored. Which is why, perhaps, in the 16th and 17th centuries, so many of the great and good would proclaim more loudly than ever the virtues of emotional restraint and sealed lips.
You are listening to the BBC series Noise, a Human History.
Noise, a Human History. Restraint.
In a middle-class, God-fearing English home of the 17th century, you'd be hard-pressed to find much fun or relaxation, especially here at the family dinner table, especially if you were a teenage girl being trained into respectability.
Gentlewomen, keep your body straight in the chair and do not lean your elbows on the table. Discover not by any ravenous gesture your angry appetite. Do not bawl out aloud for anything you want, as, I hate onions, give me no pepper. But whisper softly to one. Close your lips when you eat, talk not when you have meat in your mouth, and do not smack like a pig, nor make any other noise which shall prove ungrateful to the company.
No doubt there's lots in that advice from 1675, for which many parents today would raise a glass of their own. But in The Gentlewoman's Companion, or A Guide to the Female Sex, from which that extract came, we find that this standard of behaviour was expected all day long, wherever you were.
Neglect not what you are to do by vain prattling in the school. Make no noise that you may neither disturb your mistress or schoolfellows. In the intervals of school time, be not rude and boisterous.
And when going with your parents to church,
do not proclaim publicly to the whole congregation your levity and vanity by laughing, talking, pointing with your finger and nodding.
Even last thing at night.
Going to bed, make no noise that may disturb any of the family, but more especially your parents.
Indeed, the guiding principle for all children, but especially young ladies, was clear.
Maid should be seen, not heard. Not that they should not speak, but they should not be too talkative. A traveller sets himself out best by discourse, but a maid is best set out in silence.
Of course, silence didn't really reign in most family homes, but in the 16th and the 17th centuries, there was a new emphasis on self-discipline in everyday life, and with it, a revulsion against noise of every kind.
Across Europe and in the new colonies of America, city authorities and religious leaders trimmed back the number of festival days in the social calendar. They banned singing and feasting from public squares, tore down maypoles, and ordered unruly street parties to be replaced by more sedate processions of holy relics. A whole new set of social rules was in circulation about how and when to speak, about laughing, eating, dancing, music, about what you should listen to and what you shouldn't. In England, Elizabethan writers explained in graphic detail how spitting, snorting and breaking wind were beastly acts, which, though once indulged freely, were now best avoided. By the 18th century, English writers found it difficult even to mention such vulgarities. Here's Lord Chesterfield in 1748.
Frequent and loud laughter is the characteristic of folly and ill manners. It is the manner in which the mob express their silly joy at silly things. There is nothing so illiberal and so ill-bred as audible laughter, not to mention the disagreeable noise it makes.
Why did it happen, this apparent crushing of spontaneous expression and communal fun? Was it a result of dogmatic religion, a form of class warfare, or simply a natural reaction to the world itself becoming a louder place in which to live? There were certainly lots of complaints about rising levels of noise well before the Industrial Revolution. Here in Oxford in 1610, among all the bustling shops and taverns and street hawkers, there was a house with a second floor room that was leased out to the musician John Bosley. The city authorities stipulated that he could only practice between certain hours. But he also ran a dancing school, and we find that years later, councillors were still insisting that there were certain things he mustn't do.
Dance nor suffer any dancing after 10 o'clock at night, nor before 5 o'clock in the morning.
At this time, Oxford was twice the size of Manchester, and it was filled with workshops and cottage industries, often all jumbled up with houses. In the noisiest towns, legislators responded. So in 1595, for instance, an act stipulated that in London,
no hammerman, such as a smith, a pewterer, a founder, and all artificers making great sound, shall not work after the hour of 9 in the night, nor before the hour of 4 in the morning.
The same curfew applied to domestic noises. No man, the law said, should cause any outcry by beating his wife or servant, at least not after 9 o'clock in the evening. It's difficult to know if life really was getting noisier or people were just becoming more sensitive. Both, probably. But either way, it was impractical for secular authorities to detect and punish every breach of the law. On a daily basis, good conduct depended on the instinctive observance of social convention, and that, in turn, reflected deeply rooted religious morality about sound. It's why the ancient fear of corruption through seeing something or hearing something inappropriate was still alive, and why the gentlewoman's companion was infused from beginning to end with the idea that people could be improved, moulded, refashioned by the senses.
Let there be a strict watch to keep unviolated the two gates of the soul, the ears and the eyes. And there will be the less fear that the ear should be surprised by the converse of such who delight in wanton and obscene discourses, which too often do pleasantly and privately insinuate themselves into the ear, carrying with them unwholesome air, which infects and poisons the purity of the soul.
As by good words evil manners are corrected, the companion said, so by evil words are good ones corrupted. It's a moral code expressed in this instance in Anglican England. Yet we'd hear much the same idea expressed in Puritan New England, where preachers regarded godly speech as something able to chisel away at the sinfulness of the world. The more you heard of it, the less sinful you'd be. Murmuring, grumbling, whispering, even singing were unruly. It's why New England Puritans were wary of so-called ranters or singing Quakers. In 17th century Arabia, in common with the rest of the Muslim world, music and singing could be heard in many mosques, just as much as prayer. The 18th century Muslim theologian Muhammad ibn Abdel Wahhab, though, introduced the idea of purging Islam of ecstatic forms of worship, involving dancing and singing and chanting, which he saw as corrupt. Other branches of Islam, notably the Sufi tradition, held firm to the idea that music could be a means of experiencing the divine. But across large parts of the Middle East, as in the West, there was more and more stress on the struggle for holiness within the individual soul. A struggle, in other words, all about self-restraint. Which is why even the gentlewoman's companion rails against lascivious and wanton ballads and a contagion of loose songs, warning that they may please the ear, yet may corrupt. People were being sorted into the godly and the wicked, but also into a social hierarchy, depending on how they listened and how much noise they made, since spontaneous self-expression was increasingly linked with the vulgar. The cult of decorum was opening wide, simmering divisions between elite and folk culture. By now, in France, some towns were beginning to organise two separate carnivals, one for the restrained middle classes, another for the unrestrained poor. Forms of entertainment diverged, operas and balls for some, fairs and revels for others. In Britain, whole new towns were soon being built to give the better off a chance to escape the din of the congested, noisy city centres. The 16th and 17th centuries did not fall silent, but by the 18th century,